for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The 2012 presidential election is more than 10 months away, but with key Republican primaries and caucuses around the corner, the pressure is on. Polls indicate Newt Gingrich's star is rising, but many party insiders question whether the former House Speaker has broad enough appeal. Joining me here in the studio to talk about the changing dynamics in the race for the Republican nomination, Lisa Lehrer of Bloomberg News and Juan Williams of Fox News. We are expecting Major Garrett of National Journal. If you'd like to join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning, Juan.
Good morning, Diane.
And good morning, Lisa.
Good morning.
Thank you both for being here. Juan, you saw last night's debate. Give us a sense of what happened between Newt Gingrich and John Huntsman.
Well, it was a little bit of a love fest. What you had here was a Lincoln-Douglas-style debate. You know, they don't really go at each other. It's that the moderators introduce topics for their discussion. And the only sort of newsy item to come out of it, Diane, was a discussion of Iran and how the U.S. is dealing with Iran and whether or not the U.S. should launch an attack, approve of an Israeli attack. And Gingrich was of a mind that pretty much the U.S. has to take some action and that a decision as to whether or not to agree with an Israeli action, it may be shortly forthcoming, as he put it.
And were there two different opinions on that?
No, Huntsman also, not really. Huntsman was of a mind, too, that the U.S. should be taking some action. Huntsman seemed a little, didn't engage the whole military act by the U.S. or Israel in the way that Gingrich did. But it's interesting to me is that, you know, they're playing to two different crowds. And even in that slight modulated response, what you see is Gingrich playing to the base, I think to the more hawkish aspects of the Republican base, and Huntsman playing to those who are thinking more in terms of diplomatic strategy, sanctions, and the like.
Lisa, what I'm interested in is the fact that the debate took place at all. Gingrich had everything to lose. John Huntsman had everything to gain. Why did Gingrich agree to it?
Well, while the differences between the candidates were pretty much, as one pointed out, non-existent, the politics of this were pretty clear. For Gingrich, debates are a format that where he really shines. He feels very comfortable in that format, particularly this type of debate where he's really just speaking extemporaneously on various topics. That's a great format for him, and it's really one that's fueled his surge. His campaign was left for dead after his staff left back in the summer, and the number of debates in the Republican primary has allowed his numbers, his polling numbers to go up and has put him at the top of the race. So this was a great opportunity for him to just sort of speak in a format he's really comfortable with. For Huntsman, Huntsman staked his entire campaign on New Hampshire. So any opportunity, and he hasn't, so far he's still in single digits in that state. So any opportunity he has to get his message out in New Hampshire is one he's going to want to take. He's a former diplomat, also very comfortable on foreign policy. This was a great opportunity for him to get a little more publicity and go head-to-head with the front runner in the race.
People keep calling John Huntsman a third-tier candidate, Juan. How important is he really in the whole hierarchy?
It's not important at all.
Not important in your view.
You could talk about potential, I suppose, but from a hardball, realpolitik aspect, he barely registers. He didn't even qualify for the last debate. In terms of money, he's spending very little. He has raised very little money, spending some of his father's money, I guess, but that's about it.
I wouldn't dismiss him completely. I agree with what Juan said, but in New Hampshire, he could have a bit of an impact. It's really crucial that Romney does extremely well in New Hampshire. He was governor of the neighboring state. He has a vacation home in the state. He's been campaigning there for basically for 5 years. So he has to do extremely well. Huntsman spent a lot of time up there, and the type of voter who his opportunity to pull voters is likely going to be pulling voters from Romney. So if you have Gingrich in the state weakening Romney, and Ron Paul has a measure of support up in New Hampshire, and then on top of that you have Huntsman providing this extra little push to pull voters away from Romney, it could have an impact for Romney, I think,
and
in New Hampshire.
Joining us now is my friend Major Garrett of National Journal. Good morning to you. In your view, how important was last night's debate between John Huntsman and Newt Gingrich?
Not as important as I think many in New Hampshire thought it might be. It was so tame, so indirect in its ability to differentiate any important differences or to lay down kind of a established worldview Republicans bring to foreign policy. And the Huntsman and Ron Paul dynamics in both Iowa and New Hampshire present an interesting question for modern American presidential politics, in my opinion. Does retail politics matter anymore, or we are entirely in a wholesale televised debate presidential politics mode? John Huntsman has done the old-fashioned, long-established retail method in New Hampshire, eschewing Iowa and going all around New Hampshire, house parties, town halls, meetings with as many as 50, 100, and as few as 5 or 6 in New Hampshire. That's the old style way of winning New Hampshire. That is the way, for those who don't remember, the way Jimmy Carter won Iowa back in 1976 and created an entire cottage industry of American presidential politics that in Iowa and New Hampshire put a premium on intimacy, contact, and not only access, but touchability. What we've seen in this presidential campaign, at least on the Republican side, is less retail, more wholesale. Evaluate me based on my debate performance and what you hear me in a speech or some other set piece kind of political presentation. If Ron Paul, as I suspect he will, does well in Iowa but can't translate it anywhere else, people will say, well, retail in Iowa is of some use, but not of national use. And if John Huntsman does okay in New Hampshire but doesn't really break through, then people will begin to really seriously question the value of retail politics. Mm. And for those of us who love presidential political coverage and who grew up as I did, my first campaign was in 1992, thought of Iowa and New Hampshire as one of the few places where you could actually see voters constantly interact with presidential candidates, test them out, test out their personality, test out their knowledge of the issues, and just test out their ability to function in a less-than-controlled atmosphere, this might not be such a good thing. Because the atmospherics now have been largely controlled, and those who have used almost exclusively those controlled atmosphere, those controlled environments, have done better than those who've gone in less controlled, more intimate settings.
What do you think, Juan?
Well, I think the times have changed. I'm a little older than Major, I guess. My first campaign was not in the 90s. I'm back, you know, in Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan. And so
I was in Iowa in 1988.
We all remember.
Absolutely. So,
but, you know, I would differ only in this very specific point, that I think that the debates have been revealing and have had tremendous impact. And so it's like you have to say, wait a second, you know what, we have learned something about the candidates from the debate, and you've seen the ups and downs on the Republican side and who's able to handle issues and who's not. I think what's really distinguished this campaign is, of course, the fact that you have two very clear base or a set of constituencies in the Republican Party, and that people are playing to one or the other, and it's almost like a competition for two nominations. And at the moment, with Gingrich and Romney holding the top positions, you see who are the winners of the separate primaries, and now we're headed into, well, who's going to win the overall primary?
And how important is Iowa, Lisa?
Well, Iowa, of course, is extremely important.
But don't forget that Hillary Clinton won Iowa in last election.
Barack Obama won.
Forgive me.
Which underscores the importance
My bad.
of Iowa. That was a surprise win for him. They had been quietly organizing, and the way they did it was they expanded the number of people going to the caucuses. They brought in all these new people, younger voters, who weren't traditionally being targeted as caucus voters. And actually, our pollster at Bloomberg News, Ann Seltzer, should get a shout-out. She was the only pollster to correctly predict that Obama would win, and she was able to – it was all in how you measured the people, the likely caucus attendees. So by expanding that world – they were able to win, and that gave the campaign the momentum moving into the next set of primaries.
Well, I think the other key here, though, about Iowa is, you know, people always say Iowa's kind of an anachronism. It's not very diverse, very small, middle America, you know, based on agriculture. It doesn't represent really what's going on in terms of all of America. And one of the things to pick up on Major's theme is that the retail politics that you see there now has been reduced because, you know, the impact of these televised debates. So people don't feel the need in some cases to go there. Newt Gingrich is just basically building an organization in Iowa as we speak, and he doesn't have much money. And Ron Paul has built a base there, and Ron Paul, I think, has the capacity to surprise a lot of people in Iowa. Yeah. But you also have to keep in mind, Iowa is just a caucus at this point. It doesn't even count in terms of delegate votes.
Right. Exactly.
And the other thing is, we need to differentiate between the Iowa experience for Democrats and the Iowa experience for Republicans. The Iowa experience for Republicans has not been largely predictive for the overall Republican nominee. Iowa's choices infrequently become the eventual Republican nominee. Also, I was there in 2007 and 2008 covering the Democrats. Everyone hit their mark in Iowa except Obama expanded the mark and expanded the potential ability to draw people to caucuses. That's why he won.
Major Garrett, he's congressional correspondent for National Journal. Short break, and we'll be right back. And welcome back. We're talking about the Republican presidential candidacy field so far. Major Garrett is here with me. He's at the National Journal. Lisa Lehr is with Bloomberg News. Juan Williams is with Fox News. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Juan, there are an awful lot of questions about Newt Gingrich from within the Republican Party. What's happening?
Well, this weekend, I think, is telling. You know, it's as if the big guns suddenly realize, oh my gosh, he really has the lead. And he not only has the lead in Iowa, if you look at the polling numbers, he has the lead in Florida, South Carolina, Pennsylvania. And he's within single digits of Romney in New Hampshire. So I think he was down to 9 points. So what you have is now lots of kind of establishment Republicans suddenly aiming their fire at Gingrich in a way that he hadn't been subjected to before, because they see him now as really someone who has a chance to come in and take this thing away from Mitt Romney.
But don't they like Gingrich?
For a long time. Well, think about the kind of attacks that we've seen. One is, remember, Republicans rebelled against him and forced him out when he was the Speaker of the House. And they say that he is an egotist. He's always, as in the language of someone who was a Romney surrogate, he's always comparing himself to Reagan and Churchill. He's always presenting himself as the smartest man in the room, the bright politician with all the ideas. So you've seen people come out and say, you know, this guy is really a gas bag. And don't forget about all the marriages. All of this has been coming out this weekend in a roar, and it's very clear that the Republican establishment is uncomfortable with Newt Gingrich.
Lisa.
But as much as the Republican establishment here in Washington doesn't like Gingrich, voters really like him a lot. They, based on his poll numbers, that's for sure, and also based on talking to folks in these early primary states, they want someone who's a fighter, who can really go head-to-head and just take it to President Obama, and they see that in Gingrich, and that's largely based on his debate performances. And that's something that the Romney camp recognizes as well. I was just with them yesterday up in New Hampshire, and they acknowledge that Republican voters, there is an appeal to Gingrich to the Republican electorate, and it is that fieriness. And that's not something that comes very naturally to Romney, I think.
Major.
The Gingrich story is a long-running story. It has many components to it. I wrote in National Journal last week describing what Juan was talking about a moment ago as almost feral anxiety over Newt Gingrich becoming not only the nominee, but potentially a president of the United States. And here is why. Many Republicans have great affection for Newt Gingrich as a leader of a movement. He worked with Tom DeLay, Bill Paxon, Dick Armey, John Boehner, Republican politicians, none of whom liked each other at the time that they led the Republican majority in 1994, but they subsumed and swallowed all of their distaste for each other for a larger goal, in large measure because Newt Gingrich pointed the direction. And the direction was the first Republican majority in 40 years in the House, which Republicans understood was a means by which to control the appropriations process, the tax writing process, and to have an argument with the sitting Democratic president about the future of this country. And they had the argument. And they lost the politics, but they won much more of the policy than most Americans readily appreciate. Remember, Bill Clinton, as president, at first did not even conceptually embrace the idea of a balanced budget. Then he embraced it over 10 years. Then he went to 9. Then he went to 8. Then he went to 7. Then he agreed to something no American president had ever agreed to before, allowing the Congressional Budget Office to count the beans. Not the Office of Management and Budget, not the executive branch, but ceding as a president what constituted a balanced budget to the Congressional Budget Office. This is why, ladies and gentlemen, the Congressional Budget Office is the obsessive scorekeeper of everything in Washington. It happened in 1995. Republicans have deep affection for all of those hard-won gains, welfare reform, telecommunications reform. Much of it would not happen without Newt Gingrich. And yet, with all of those accomplishments, they remember Newt Gingrich as the manager, the egoist, the flamethrower, the person who veered radically right to left in sort of a careening way with their own leadership of the Republican congressional majority. And they found themselves exhausted by this process. Newt Gingrich left. He resigned after the midterm elections in 1998. But I remembered, and I was reminded of this, when he was first up for re-election in January of 1997, in the teeth of the ethics scandal related to his GOPAC efforts before he became speaker, agreed to pay a fine of $300,000, the first sanctioned speaker in the history of the United States Congress. Newt Gingrich went into that election, his first as speaker, and his closest aides to this day tell me they weren't sure they had the votes to be reelected speaker the very first time. This is 6 months before the aborted coup against Newt Gingrich. So those who worked closest with Newt Gingrich remember how difficult it was to follow him and how hard it was to understand his executive leadership approach. And they think about him holding all that executive power as president, and they quaver.
Okay, so you've got Washington insiders, leadership people who are very nervous about Newt Gingrich. But apparently, people out there are saying, we like what he says, we like the way he sounds, we think he's the one to go up against Obama and win, Lisa.
I also think there's another piece of this, which is that Americans love a good reinvention story. And that's part of what Gingrich is doing here. And you're seeing that particularly on the issue of his personal life, right? He's on his third marriage. He had an affair while he was dealing with the Clinton impeachment proceedings. So he's someone that hasn't always had the type of personal life that you think would appeal to social conservatives, to evangelicals. But a lot of those voters, when I've spoken to them in Iowa or in South Carolina, say, listen, you know, he's come out. He said he's changed. He's now a grandfather. He took this yesterday. He took this pledge that he would be faithful and not cheat on his wife. He certainly I sort of thought that's what marriage was. But there was also another pledge put out by a conservative group that he signed. And so that's you know, and some evangelical voters have told me that that's sort of a part of their faith, that you can find forgiveness and you can you know, approach this differently.
I think you've just answered this email question, a statement more than a question. It says, it's beyond my comprehension how so-called values voters could endorse the candidacy of Newt Gingrich. He's an admitted serial adulterer. He bought his annulment from the Vatican to marry his former mistress after having converted to Catholicism. He's a Washington insider who, while he denies it, is a lobbyist. How can these voters subscribe to Gingrich as president?
Well, let me add to the indictment a point of humor, which is to say that, you know, from the perspective of someone who's been watching Gingrich for a while, it's kind of unbelievable that he has been the principal beneficiary of the fall of a man who was accused of sexual harassment and philandering, which is Herman Cain. And all those votes seem to have gone to Newt Gingrich without missing a beat. So that's kind of funny, but I think the reason is that he is viewed as the true conservative, Diane. The true conservative, especially as contrasted to Mitt Romney. Now, over the weekend, again, as part of the onslaught of attacks coming from the establishment Republican Party against Newt Gingrich, you've seen claims that, you know, he's not a real conservative. Don't forget, he was sitting next to Nancy Pelosi on global warming. Don't forget, he was doing deals with Bill Clinton. Don't forget, on and on about, you know, individual mandate, all the rest, the flip-flops in Newt Gingrich's career. But that's not what the voters see. They see someone who is far clearer as a conservative, someone who led a conservative revolution successfully in the past than Mitt Romney.
And I think, you know, there's also a component of what Republican voters are not allowed to evaluate. I wrote about this last week, and I had a headline for my column, said Newt by proxy. And I said one of the reforms that Newt Gingrich brought in when he was Speaker was no proxy voting in congressional committee, meaning a powerful chairman couldn't vote on behalf of 20 Democrats who didn't show up. So that's ironic because a lot of Republicans didn't show up to this race. And by not showing up to this race, they have by proxy elevated Newt Gingrich. Imagine a debate platform thus. Paul Ryan, Haley Barbour, John Thune, Chris Christie, Mitch Daniels, Newt Gingrich, Mitt Romney. I would suggest to this audience, and I've suggested in my column, that Newt Gingrich simply does not find the traction and the purchase he has in this campaign running against these contemporary Republican politicians who have real-time, relevant success and have fought with the issues of today in real-time electoral processes, but they didn't run. And because they didn't run, Newt Gingrich against a field that is not populated with these kind of heavyweights has been able to rise.
You know, I think he's certainly, as Juan pointed out, flip-flopped more, the same amount, if not more, than Mitt Romney. He's changed positions on the individual mandate. He's changed positions on government bailouts and a host of things. But Republican voters, they know him. They've seen him on Fox News for years. They've bought his books. They've seen his documentaries. A lot of them have heard him speak, you know, in live and in person. So they feel like even though he has changed positions on all these issues, even though he's had a relatively turbulent personal life, they know him, they see him as authentic, and they've seen him sort of in this conservative universe for a very long time.
Juan, let me ask you about Newt Gingrich's statements regarding the Palestinians. It seemed to come out of nowhere and seemed to shock everybody.
Well, he said the Palestinians are an invented people, Diane, which is, I mean, well, first of all, it's just not historically true. You know, what you have here is a situation where you can go back through various eras and hierarchies, but you know, the Palestinians have been there. And you can say, oh, they're part of Jordan or they're part of the Saudi Empire or whatever, but clearly there was a Palestinian people. But when you stop and think about why he's doing this, again, it's playing to the conservative base. It says, you know what, we have to be strong supporters of Israel in every case, and we are Israel's friends, and we are going to be Israeli supporters, and that's all it is. But it is the history of it, and the way that he would dismiss it, as someone wrote in the paper the other day, you know, the United States is an invented people. There are lots of invented people.
I said people. That this morning. Yeah.
I mean, but this is exactly the kind of statement that the Romney campaign is jumping on in their hope to portray him as someone who's erratic, as someone who sort of speaks out of turn and says statements that can get him in trouble, particularly when he's up against the big fight against President Obama. And they've come out that stronger and stronger in the past couple weeks. They've rolled out a number of surrogates who have just whacked the heck out of Gingrich on conference calls and in speeches. And yesterday in New Hampshire, Mitt Romney came out for the first time I've seen in front of voters in a town hall meeting and just took a big couple of swings at Gingrich. He whacked him for taking the $1.6 million from Freddie Mac for his work consulting for the company.
As a historian.
Right. Gingrich, of course, says he wasn't a lobbyist.
Best paid historian in American history.
Yeah, exactly.
That's exactly, of course, what Romney said. So they hit him for that. They sort of tried to paint him as a K Street insider. And they used that critique to make a more, even what I thought was an even more devastating argument, could potentially devastating argument, which was that he doesn't understand the economy.
Lisa Lehr, Bloomberg News, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. What about all these other people on the stage? What about Ron Paul? What about Michelle Bachmann? What about Rick Perry? What about all of these others?
Well, Rick Perry may have a moment in Iowa. He is certainly doing everything he possibly can to restructure his campaign and have a moment in Iowa. And it's, I guess, theoretically possible that he could have a moment in Iowa, but it needs to be a big one. He needs to finish in the top three. And that's going to be very difficult to do because you're going to have Gingrich, Ron Paul, and Mitt Romney. And if Rick Perry finishes a close fourth, that's simply not enough to credibly carry himself on to New Hampshire. Rick Perry started so aggressively. The Romney campaign had a well-thought-out 5 or 6-point plan to completely kneecap Rick Perry. They did so. He certainly helped them in that process. And what I've always thought in the last couple of weeks is if Romney has a 5-point plan for Gingrich, they better set it in motion. I haven't seen it set in motion, and I would say to Lisa's point about Romney surrogates against Gingrich, for anyone who is in the conservative movement who has a sense at all of institutional knowledge, sending out former New Hampshire Governor John Sununu and former George Herbert Walker Bush significant John Sununu to attack Newt Gingrich is about the least effective mechanism humanly imaginable.
Lisa.
Because
Sununu
and Gingrich clashed over George Herbert Walker Bush breaking his solemn pledge at the 1988 Republican Convention in New Orleans.
No.
Read my lips, no new taxes. And Gingrich made a political calculation that would be death to the long-term interests of the Republican Party, fought the White House on that, and won. Not in 92, but won in 94. And for Romney to rely on Sununu to carry that argument against Gingrich in this context is beyond imagining.
Well, it's a New Hampshire play.
It just doesn't work.
In New Hampshire, he's playing in New Hampshire. But he also, of course, sent out Chris Christie, which is probably
much better.
Better surrogate. But I think the larger advantage that the Romney campaign has in this fight is structural. They have been running for 5 years. They have a massive organization in practically every state. They have the internet component. They have everything sort of laid out there. Gingrich really just started hiring people in Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina. Really, the first and most important contest in October. He ended the last financial quarter in debt. They're still trying to recover from that. You know, obviously he'll have more money this time, but he just doesn't have the structure in place that Romney has. And if you are going to get into a protracted nomination battle that could go into February or beyond, that takes that kind of structure.
You know, it's the whole notion is to get back to this point that Gingrich somehow for the Republican establishment is not trustworthy. He's the guy who said of Paul Ryan's budget plan, this is right-wing social engineering and the like. But when I think of Gingrich going forward, I think that for the voters, he is trustworthy. They see him as reliably conservative, whereas they don't see that from Mitt Romney. So we're not, you know, that's why when he, you know, Mitt Romney came out with this thing about return the money from Freddie Mac, Gingrich was immediately able to say, well, what about all the money, again, from a more populist Republican stance, what about all the money that was earned by Mitt Romney from Bain Capital when Mitt Romney was running that and closing companies, putting people out of work and the like? Now, again, the Republican establishment has shot back at that in the last day or so by saying, oh, my gosh, that's a liberal critique of capitalism because a hedge fund is taking risk and sometimes the risk profits and sometimes it doesn't for shareholders. What is he now, you know, adopting some kind of progressive argument against Republicans? So it's very interesting to watch because it's like an internal fight among a very small group of people, the Republicans at this point, especially the Republicans who are deciding who will be their nominee. But it's fascinating.
Juan Williams of Fox News, and we'll take just a short break here. We've got lots of calls from Florida, Kentucky, Texas, Ohio, Oklahoma, and Illinois. We'll get to them as soon as we come back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. By EBSCO, supporting libraries with electronic resource discovery and management solutions, journal subscriptions, and EBSCO host databases. And by the Doris Duke Foundation for Islamic Art, seeking to improve Americans' understanding of Muslim arts and cultures. This is NPR.
Since the recession, the number of adult children living with parents has jumped by nearly 26%. What the trend of boomerang kids means for families and society, the Diane Rehm Show. Next hour. Welcome back, and our first caller in Ormond Beach, Florida. Good morning, Tomasini. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning, Diane. Many say that Romney isn't conservative enough for Republican voters. To me, that meant he's not nasty enough. For years now, conservatives have become more and more pugnacious, especially after Obama won the election. After we invaded Iraq, no WMDs were found, but Bush joked at a press dinner about looking for the lost WMDs under his desk. Republicans called Senator Max Cleland a triple amputee veteran. He was a terrorist sympathizer to them because he opposed the war in Iraq. And who can forget conservative darling Ann Coulter calling the widows of 9/11 victims of the 9/11 victims Jersey whores cashing in on their husbands' debts. And look at the recent Republican debates, how nasty the audiences are. Newt Gingrich fits the bill for many conservatives as a nasty, in-your-face leader. Truthfully, I think the Republicans are self-destructing.
Juan Williams.
Well, as I said earlier, it's a smaller slice, and I think much of the prime engine that's been driving Republican politics, certainly since the victories in 2010 with the Tea Party freshmen in the Congress, has been the Tea Party. And the anger over, expressions of anger, very loud at those town hall meetings over the Obama Affordable Health Care Act, that's been the driving animus, that plus anger at President Obama. I mean, if there's any one point that they all agree on, it's we've got to get rid of President Obama, and they call him socialist and too much regulations and all the rest. You know the rhetoric. So, and I think a lot of this plays into talk radio anger and animus and the kind of just people want a fighter. I think Lisa might have touched on this earlier. I think in many ways they want someone who's going to be in the debates and really take it to President Obama and challenge him and call him out. And they see more of that from Newt Gingrich than they do from Mitt Romney.
And would that be a successful mode of operation with the president?
I think the president's a pretty intelligent guy who's quite a capable debater and speaker, so I'm not sure how it would work. I think clearly Gingrich would come across as the hotter personality in that debate. For me, the question is, how would it play with swing voters? In other words, you know, in my mind, I'm always saying that the person who decides this upcoming election is a suburban white woman in Columbus, Ohio, who doesn't pay much attention to politics.
All right, let's go to a male voter in Columbus, Ohio. Good morning.
Almost on cue.
Good morning, Michael. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Yeah, thank you. I think a lot of it is maybe not understanding conservatives out here in the heartland or outside of the coast. The primary reason, first of all, there's not a great candidate, so we understand that. But then you look at what you have, and if it's Newt versus Romney, there's hands down no question among real conservatives that it's going to have to be Newt. And here's why. Romney is, you just look at the guy, he's been running forever. He's a pure creature of the Republican establishment. I left the Republican Party 10 years ago. For the Republican establishment gave us George Bush twice, gave us McCain, and now they're trying to shove Romney down our throats. And a lot of my friends, and I'm in some libertarian circles too, if Romney gets the nomination, we're staying home or we're voting libertarian, because the guy has never governed conservatively. Newt has got a lot of problems, but he governed conservatively for the most part. Yes, he's given in on a couple things tactically, but Newt is a strategic conservative. Romney, it's all about the power. It's all about the packaging. He's just another country club Republican trying to be pushed on us by the establishment. And as much as he tries to package, and as much as his high-priced consultants try to package it to us, we're not that stupid.
All right. Thanks for calling, Major.
Michael touched on a couple of important points. I have a blog post up on our National Journal website today on our Decoded 2012 blog that talks about the Saturday debate, because some people thought it was a nigh-on savage thing for Newt Gingrich to look to Mitt Romney and say, well, the only reason you're not a career politician is because you didn't beat Ted Kennedy in 1994. Ooh, wow, that was such a rough thing for him to say. I pointed out that, believe me, Newt Gingrich could have said far rougher things to Mitt Romney about 1994. He could have said, for example, in the course of that campaign against Edward Kennedy, the sitting Democratic senator from Massachusetts, when asked about the contract with America, Mitt Romney said, oh, that's a bad idea. I disagree with that. No party should say what they're going to do and promise to do it. We shouldn't have Republican winners or Democratic losers. Well, that's a perfectly defensible, middle-of-the-road, accommodationist point of view, probably necessary in a state like Massachusetts. Repellent, ladies and gentlemen, to conservatives who remember that era and remember the challenge to Bill Clinton and what came of Republicans fighting over the balanced budget, welfare reform, tax cuts, et cetera, et cetera. Mitt Romney also said in the course of that campaign, when alleged by Ted Kennedy that you want to bring back Reagan-Bush policies, Mitt Romney said, I was an independent during the Reagan-Bush era. I don't want to do anything that would bring back Reagan-Bush. Okay.
Lisa.
But I think it is important to remember that while those types of statements and policies are, as Major pointed out, repellent to conservatives, once you get out of the primary, the competition becomes for independence. And the conventional wisdom is pretty much what one of, I think, our first caller pointed out. those kinds of statements of working across the aisle or being willing to cross party lines are appealing to independents. And the conventional wisdom is that Romney would be a stronger candidate in the general election against Obama than Gingrich. However, it is important to note that the White House, with Gingrich's rise, has started preparing for a potential, you know, Gingrich being the nominee. And they do see a few areas that would make him tough. One is they think he might be more appealing to Latino voters, who, of course, are a crucial swing population, will be a crucial swing population in the general. They also think it's harder to use one of their attack lines that they would use against Romney, which was that he doesn't understand the problems of the middle class and he just sides with Wall Street because of his background, of course, working for Wall Street as CEO of the private equity firm Bain Capital. That's a tougher line to work against Newt Gingrich, they've said.
All right, to Florence, Kentucky. Good morning, Terry.
Good morning. I was just wondering if your panel would agree that Gingrich and Romney are leading in the public's opinions only because the Republicans really have no real qualified presidential candidate within their party except them, so that then they step forward.
Juan.
Well, I don't know how you would determine qualified. I mean, I think that's a subjective thing, but I think that, you know, Major and others have said they don't think this is a great field. I don't think that's much argument about that. And then, of course, you go to the fact that people like Mitch Daniels, Chris Christie have decided not to run.
What's happened to Michelle Bachmann?
Well, I think that Michelle Bachmann had some missteps. Initially, she was quite the queen of the ball because she was the Tea Party candidate. I mean, everyone was looking to her as almost a surrogate for Sarah Palin. Was Sarah Palin going to get in or not? But Michelle Bachmann had that same energy, that same feistiness. And by the way, Michelle Bachmann, going back to Saturday's debate, has been advancing the argument that, you know what, it's really Romney Gingrich as the same item, that they're the same person. They're both kind of establishment Republicans, and that she's the true alternative. But it hasn't allowed her to gain any traction.
And Michelle Bachmann is an Iowa phenomenon through and through within the context of this presidential campaign. And on this very show several months ago, we raised the question back when Michelle Bachmann was considering a leadership race within the House Republicans. I sat here and said, Michelle Bachmann will not win. She will not get 10 votes. And about a week later, she dropped out of the campaign because, much like Gingrich, people who work alongside of her, who know her, don't much like her, don't believe her, and don't want to follow her. That's an institutional problem, politician to politician. It's the same thing being visited upon Gingrich now, but it was visited much earlier on Michelle Bachmann. And at the retail level, she succeeded in Iowa, but she has not found traction elsewhere.
And that same point is being raised in Galveston, Texas. Jim, you had that same question.
Yes, I did. Thank you. Are we looking at a do-nothing executive branch now with Gingrich? I mean, it's just like we have this turbulent history of his with not only his personal life, but his political life. He can't seem to keep a field staff with his current campaign. And will people be able to work with him, either for him or communicate with him, negotiate with him? It sounds like he's just really an impossible person to get anything done with.
That's an interesting point, Lisa.
Well, that's certainly the argument the Romney campaign has been making. But I want to jump back to an earlier point, which is that this unhappiness with the field amongst the Republican electorate, and I think that's definitely true, and we saw that as it was getting sorted out, as a lot of Republicans, particularly establishment Republicans, were pushing, were urging Haley Barbour to get in the race, and we're urging Mitch Daniels, then of course Chris Christie, all those guys took a pass, and this is the field that they have left. The question now is whether Republicans' unhappiness with not having the perfect candidate will outweigh their dislike of President Obama. And I think just from talking to voters out there that the dislike of President Obama is stronger than the desire to have a perfect candidate. So when it comes to the general election, all these voters, even some who say they will stay home, will say in the end that they would rather vote against Obama, even if they're not necessarily totally sold on voting for Romney or Gingrich or whoever. They just want to vote against Obama.
All right. To Sycamore, Illinois. Good morning, Hamish.
Yes, good morning. I'm an independent voter, and to me, it doesn't matter what their percentages are in the vote or how much money they have. if he's got enough signatures to get on the ballot, people need to be heard. And I think Mr. Huntsman is one of those people. He's got international and domestic experience. And the news media seems to be focus on the controversial people and not to what people are saying. And we're not a bunch of sheep, and I'm wondering why the news media continues just to concentrate on controversial people instead of what they're saying.
Well, now, here's an email from Don in Washington, who has another perspective about John Huntsman. He says, Huntsman has squandered a great opportunity to be one of the front runners. He has the experience and foreign policy knowledge to win the nomination, but he's allowed himself to be best known for one-liners during debates and his daughter's videos. So it would seem as though while Hamish thinks that John Huntsman is the only dependable candidate that he as an independent can vote for, others feel very differently.
Yeah, and look, this is a continuum that the media constantly evaluates. And when you have regular exposure to voters and you don't develop any momentum, it's harder to justify using finite resources to constantly cover everything you do. Now, John Huntsman has coverage. He has coverage every day in New Hampshire, in Iowa, in South Carolina, and in the national media. I would actually say that John Huntsman has gotten more coverage than, for example, Rick Santorum, and they're about the same place in the polling data in both states. I would say Huntsman has probably gotten the better of that alternative. And I want to go back to Jim's point about Gingrich as a manager real quick. I wrote about this last week in National Journal. Gingrich, as a person, as a theorist, is addicted, obsessed with management theory. Back in the 90s, he was obsessed with Edward Deming and total quality management. And he used total quality management with all of his aides. You guys need to read all this. He would send them to Fort Monroe in Virginia, his senior staff. Go learn about the 21st century Army fighting methods. Bring me back after action reports about everything we did. And they did. Here's the problem. The after action reports would be debated in senior staff meetings, and the conclusion would be, well, Mr. Speaker, what went wrong is you. And he would say, no, that's fundamentally wrong. That's a total wrong answer. Do that again. And they would all look at their shoes and be like,
whoa.
Okay. So this is what the manager Gingrich brings to the table.
Major Garrett of National Journal, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. One more question on Huntsman from Fred in Hot Springs Village, Arkansas. Is John Huntsman's real goal to be a vice presidential candidate on the Republican ticket, Juan?
I don't know. It's not clear to me what the real goal is. Lisa and I were talking, and I said, well, maybe he wants to be the Romney of 2016, the guy who came in second and therefore is the front runner going into the next cycle. I don't know, but it's not clear to me at this juncture because, I mean, on the basis of the poll numbers, you know, it's just not there. There's going to be a fundraiser tomorrow, I guess, for Romney in New York among the big, big fundraisers, the Wall Street types. And, you know, Huntsman could be in that game, but he's not. They're not taking him seriously.
All right, and to Hagerstown, Maryland. Good morning, Leon.
Good morning. I don't know if any of you guys got to watch the conversation between Huntsman and Gingrich.
Yes.
He's a fan. And I thought what that did for me, being a Democrat, is it started to fill out some of the intellectual ability that Gingrich has to enunciate his vision of the world and his vision of what he would do. It's quite possible that he's all theory and not able to deliver because of his inability to control himself or whatever. But he does. I think he presents a much more formidable candidate if he gets a nomination than any of the other people. And I think that he delivers a message that will begin to resonate with Democrats once they start listening to him, and it's going to be at the Democrats' peril if we don't take in account the fact that he has a lot of substance to him, at least appears to have a lot of substance.
All right, Lisa.
That is really the number one thing I hear when I travel to these early primary votes states from voters, which is that they like Gingrich because they think he's smart and they think he can go head-to-head with Obama in the debates. Which is an interesting thing, I think, because, of course, there's only three presidential debates in the general election. And while they're really, really important, it's not like the primary process, which is, I think there's 18 or so debates in this primary. We've had, I want to say, a dozen or so. So they've really, as we talked about earlier in the show, they've really set the agenda for a lot of this race.
Do you think they've been worthwhile for the American public?
I think they've changed how the race has happened, in the way that we were talking about before. I think they've allowed candidates that really haven't had an infrastructure, someone like maybe a Herman Cain, who really had no operation. He literally had one guy in New Hampshire, just a guy. He was Herman Cain's guy in New Hampshire. He wasn't even going to those states very much. He would go on bus tours of Ohio and states that don't play a role in the primary process. And they allowed him to stay in the race much longer than I think would have happened without the debates.
All right. Well, much, much more to come. Lisa Lehrer, Bloomberg News, Juan Williams of Fox News, Major Garrett of National Journal. Thank you all.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Nikki Jex, Susan Neighbors, and Lisa Dunn. And the engineer is Toby Schreiner. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from